in chief, which has been my goal for the past 3 years, but I can't seem to motivate. Egg rolls, scallion pancakes, General Tso's, all the bad stuff, my mom says, dropping a bulging bag of Chinese food onto the counter. She kicks off her shoes. Does grief make your feet swell? Because these things are freaking killing me. I don't know. I get up and set the table for two, not the usual three. I need to stop noticing details like this. How was your day? As bad as you expected? My mom kisses me on my head and then decides I need a hug, too. Not really. I mean, it wasn't good. I don't tell her I skipped class. No need to freak her out. But you were right. I needed to go. Yours? I kicked ass, took names, even landed a new account. Not bad for a Monday. That's cool, I say, and we toast with our glasses. I need to up my game on the financial front. Wrinkles I haven't noticed before bracket her mouth. She shouldn't have to up her game. She already works too hard as it is, bangs on her laptop after dinner and dashes off emails late into the night. When I was younger and brattier, I used to complain that she loved her work more than she loved me. Now that I'm older, I realize that's not true. My mother is just one of those people you miss, even when she's sitting right in front of you. I didn't think about the money thing, I say, and my stomach cramps with guilt. Soon there will be my college tuition, and what about when I leave? My mom will come home every day to this big empty house. A team of three, knocked down to two, and then finally, just one. Will she sell this place? I hope not. Don't worry, no one's going to starve. But you know what's really stressing me out? How do I know when to change the oil in the car? Or what the name of our home insurance company is? And all our online passwords, I don't have any of them. My mom says. Your name? Birthday? I feel completely in over my head. Work, I can handle. It's the rest. It's real life that's the problem. I think about how my mom doesn't really have lots of people around to help other than me. My grandparents retired and moved back to Delhi like a million years ago. She and her parents have this complicated relationship anyway. When my mom was a kid, her parents did everything they could to make sure she assimilated into American culture, paid for her to go to a fancy-pants, mostly white, private school they could barely afford, even packed PB&J in her lunchbox because the other kids used to tease her that her Indian food was too stinky. The way she tells it, they raised her as an American, and then were surprised and resentful when she didn't turn out to share their old-school values. I'm pretty sure old-school values in this case actually means not cool with the fact that she fell in love and married a white dude, because otherwise she's totally on board with the rest of their beliefs. Well, except for the fact that she's a straight-up, unapologetic carnivore and gets her hair cut and colored every 6 weeks. Still, we go to Gurdwara in Glenrock one Sunday a month, and my dad used to come with us sometimes, though less for a religious awakening and more for the homemade Indian food, which admittedly, now that I'm old enough to have a choice in the matter, is why I go too. At my grandmother's request, my mom keeps in touch with all the relatives, even though they are in Delhi and Vancouver and London, and distantly related and kind of a pain in the ass. And though I'm not quite fluent, my mom has taught me enough Punjabi that I can get by. My mother may be American-born, but she's never forgotten we're Indian, too. Everyone pretends things are okay with my impossible-to-please grandparents. We go to visit them in Delhi every other year, though my dad always stayed behind because he had to work. We pretended this was true, and that it had nothing to do with the fact that my grandparents didn't approve of him. Whenever my mom talks to BBG on the phone, she always puts on a voice I associate with her work, the advertising executive voice. My mom's conversations with her parents have mostly consisted of a recitation of our small accomplishments. My grades, my mom's landing an account, my dad getting a local business award. As if these things are part of some campaign pitch that she made the right choices. And whenever I wear a lenga or a salwar kameez for some second cousin twice removed's birthday party, which requires 3 hours in the car to the middle of Pennsylvania, my mother makes sure to take a picture and email it to BBG immediately. See, she seems to want to say, nothing's been lost here. I'm passing it all along. Here's the sad and horrifying part. The second I put on my Indian clothes, an alert goes out to her parents. Yet when my dad died, my mom didn't even call them until the day after the funeral. My mother explained to me that she knew they were traveling to a wedding that weekend and couldn't get back to the United States in time, so there was no point messing up their plans. Honestly, I think my mom didn't want to know if they would come to pay their respects. Of course, I like to believe they would have. They may not have approved of my mom marrying my dad, but they're not monsters. They're just backwards. And, okay, a little bit racist. Oddly enough, though they may not like the fact that I'm half white, they always compliment me on the color of my skin. So fair, BBG always says. Like that's a wonderful, important thing, the fact that I'm a couple of shades lighter than my mother.
And I can see you enjoy your food.
I'll help you figure it all out, I say to my mother. I'm sorry. Oh, honey, don't say that. It's going to be fine. You have nothing to be sorry for. I shouldn't have said anything. I make myself busy dishing out the food, spoon out huge piles onto our plates. There are people who don't eat when they are sad, who lose their appetite and get crazy skinny. My mom and I are not those people. I love you, Mommy, I say. As soon as the words are out, I feel bad again because it makes her eyes fill. I want her to know that I realize just how lucky I got in the mother department. That if I had to pick anyone in the whole world to go through this with, to have as a mom, it would be her. Only her. This is partially grief talking. Before all this, my mom often annoyed the crap out of me. She's master of the subtle criticism disguised as a suggestion. Why don't you straighten your hair? Don't you think your nails would look so much better if you didn't bite them? That shirt is a little frumpy, no? Now, though, I feel stupid for caring about that sort of thing. She could die tomorrow. I didn't mean to make you cry. No. Good crying, I promise, she says, blotting under her eyes with a paper towel. It doesn't look like good crying. She looks on the verge of unraveling into a mess of tears and snot. Nothing like the woman she must have been at work today, fierce and tucked in and totally under control. I'm just so grateful that I have you, Kit. I know she doesn't mean for her words to sting, but they do. I'm not going anywhere, I promise, and hold up my finger for a pinky swear. A whole month without him, she says, ignoring my outstretched finger. How is that even possible? I don't know. Kit. I wait for her to finally say it, to just go ahead and mention the accident outright, and then maybe murmur a few empty words that are supposed to be comforting. I brace myself to talk about all the things she's refused to talk about until now. You have a little scallion in your teeth.
Chapter 5. David. She sits at my table again. I didn't expect her to. Told myself it didn't matter. That I sat alone 622 times, and that I like my ritual. The way I wait for Disher, the lunch lady, to be the one to serve me because she always wears gloves and, on good days, a hairnet. The way I spread my food out in front of me in the order I want to eat it. One bite from each plate, small to large, and back again. The way I switch my music over the second I sit down, from Mozart, which is best for hall navigation, to the Beatles, which is social in the way the midday meal should be. That it would be okay, too, if we didn't ever talk again. I have two new notable encounters to add to my notebook now, one in which I made Kit Lowell laugh. Out loud. She even threw back her head. This okay? She asks, though she's already sitting down. She doesn't wait for my answer, and instead reaches into her backpack and takes out an elaborate assortment of what appears to be leftover Chinese food, probably from Szechuan Gardens, which is both the number one Yelp-rated Chinese restaurant in Mapleview and also the only Chinese restaurant in Mapleview. I'm particularly fond of their hot and sour soup. You are always most welcome. From the look Kit gives me, I surmise this must be a weird thing to say. Usually, the truth is, I can't think of many people I would actually welcome to my table. Maybe Jose, who wears bifocals, or Stephanie L., whom I've never heard speak out loud. On second thought, maybe not. Jose would ask me to join the Academic League, which has happened 26 times in the past 3 years. Stephanie L., though on the plus side, decidedly nonverbal, looks like someone who would be a loud chewer. I have misophonia and would prefer not to be enraged by her rabid mastication. "Can I ask you a question?" Kit asks. I refrain from pointing out that she just asked me a question by asking me if she could ask me a question. When I noted the same thing to Miney recently, over our thrice-weekly prearranged FaceTime call, she said, "Little D, why are you so freaking annoying?" Which is, of course, also a question, but a rhetorical one. "Sure," I say now to Kit. "Why do you always sit alone?" I shrug, which is not something I often do, and it feels funny, that up-and-down shimmy of the shoulders, a little exaggerated, like a confused person in a play. "I'm not sitting alone right now." "You know what I mean," Kit says. She is eating an egg roll, and her lips are glossy with its grease. Only Kit Lowell could turn food into makeup. "There aren't that many people at this school I'd like to sit and eat with," I say, proud of myself for not adding what Miney would call too much information. When I say there aren't that many people, I really mean only you, Kit. "We're not all terrible, you know," she says, and makes a hand gesture that I take to mean there are a lot of people here to choose from, though it's entirely possible she is just shooing away a gnat. I put the odds at 80-20, I'm right. "Did you know we will spend 185.5 hours in this cafeteria this school year alone? That seems like a lot of time to spend with people with whom I have nothing in common except for 3 insignificant coincidences. One, we, like millions of other people, were born in the same year. 2, we happened to be raised in the same small town. And 3, our parents chose to send us through the Mapleview public school system." While talking, I count the numbers 1, 2, and 3 on my fingers, which my mother claims is obnoxious, and on reflection, I agree, but it's a hard habit to break. On the parental level, I can see how this is enough to form a friendship, given all the shared choices, where to move, when to have kids, etc. But for me, particularly because I didn't choose any of this, and wouldn't have chosen any of this if I were given any say in the matter, which I decidedly wasn't, it's not enough commonality. And a lot of these people you claim are not so terrible tend to be not so nice to me. So to answer your original but not first question, I think it might have been your 3rd, actually, I have better things to do with my time than to waste it on... After erring on the side that it was a gesture and not a swat, I copy Kit's wavy hand motion, which also feels a little theatrical, but appropriate, and also very, very Kit. "These people." "Nice speech," she says. "I feel that way too sometimes. Not the people not being nice thing so much, but the nothing in common thing. Who knows, maybe everyone feels like that. I didn't ask you what I really wanted to know, which is, I guess, my 3rd or 4th question. Do you get lonely sitting here? Being by yourself all the time?" I look up at her, meet her eyes. Green, green, green. Today she's not wearing a man's shirt. Instead, she has on a sweater that looks soft, the kind that when I was a kid, I would stop and pet whenever my mom forced me to go shopping. It's light yellow, the color of a baby chick. She wears a thin gold necklace with a big scripted K charm that she massages a lot with the rhythmic rubbing of forefinger and thumb, like it's a cross or rosary beads. Her jeans are ripped, and her knees peek out of the holes. I wonder if they are cold. The cafeteria is loud, so much louder without my headphones, which I took off when I first saw Kit head toward me and this table. I remember now why I like to wear them. You're up to 5 questions, I say. And yes, of course I get lonely, just like everyone else. See, you have more in common with us than you thought, she says, and smiles, like what I said was something happy, not sad, which is weird because I thought it was quite clearly the latter. My turn for a question, I say, a declarative statement, albeit a superfluous one. What made you pick my table? Honestly, I knew you'd leave me alone if I asked you to. I'm not dealing so well at the moment, if you hadn't noticed. I hadn't noticed, actually, but I don't say that. She looks fine to me. Much better than fine. Luminous, even. And I just can't take everyone, you know, watching me all the time. Like, if I were eating this in front of Vi and Annie, they'd be all judgy about me eating my feelings about, you know, everything, which, of course, I know I am. I really don't need them to hint that I don't want to get any fatter. That would imply you are already fat, I say. And you're not fat. I mean, you're not skinny either. I'd say your average weight for your height, maybe 5 pounds above average in your legs. She laughs. This is the second time I've made her laugh, and it feels just as good as the first. Thank you for that, she says. I guess straight-up honesty was one way to go. You're welcome. You shouldn't worry about your weight. You'd still look beautiful, fat. You have plenty of room to grow. I try to make eye contact again, but this time she's the one looking away. Her cheeks are flushed. Are you warm? I ask. It's freezing in here. It's approximately 66 degrees inside, but maybe it feels colder to her because of her bare knees. Do you have eczema? I ask. Clearly, her sympathetic nervous system has caused her blood vessels to dilate. The best way for me to figure out the cause is by process of elimination. I am not good with social niceties, but I know enough not to ask outright if I've embarrassed her. That's random. No, why? No reason. Ha! Another lie! I'm getting good at this. I like that expression, eat your feelings. I keep a list of idioms. I'll have to add that one. You're an idiom, she says, and at first my stomach drops. She is making fun of me. But then I look up and see she's wearing a friendly smile. This is good teasing, I think. This is banter, like in the old romantic comedies my mother likes to watch. I've never been much good at banter, which necessarily requires quick wit and an understanding of what to say next. Thank you very much for that, I say, and then it's my turn to blush. No need to go through a process of elimination. I know what caused it. I watch a lot of movies, mostly as sociological research, but also because I have a lot of time to fill. And what I've gleaned from them is that teenagers are supposed to actively dislike their parents. We should ask to be dropped a block away from school and on Saturday nights complain about our curfews. We should steal from our parents' liquor cabinets, get drunk in parking lots with our friends, and make stupid decisions that lead to avoidable car accidents. We should get particularly annoyed when our mother or father asks us questions about anything involving the future or planning. One benefit to being different is that none of the above appeal to me. My parents did a terrible job of naming me, and my mom takes on average an extra 13 minutes more than necessary to buy toothpaste. My father tends to give long lectures on topics I only have a marginal interest in, like traffic patterns and ornithology, and Mimi left me behind to go to college. But I like my family. I actually look forward to our after-school discussions. "How was your day?" my mom says today, as she does every day when I get home from school. She puts a lasagna in the oven. Today is Tuesday, which is a pasta day. Lasagna is broadening the category a bit, but my dad and I try to be flexible. Tuesday also means that I have a guitar lesson, which I love even more than I hate my teacher, Trey, which is to say, a lot, and that later I will do 63 minutes of martial arts training. Kit sat at my lunch table again. "No shit," my mom says. "Seriously?" "Seriously," I say, and let her "no shit" pass without comment, even though she knows it's an expression I do not like. It makes me think of constipation, which makes me think about grunting, my least favorite noise, after squawking and chewing. I also have a list of favorite noises. It has one item on it. Kit's laugh. "Did you talk? Did you take off your headphones?" "Of course." My conversation with Kit is another notable encounter, a positive, notable encounter, so pleasant that I don't want to put it in my notebook. I want to pretend for just a moment that this is not a rare occurrence, that this sort of thing happens to me all the time, that I'm not the sort of person who even requires a notebook in the first place. I know she thinks I'm weird, but it's like she appreciates my weirdness. Like you guys, and Miney sometimes. Does that make sense? I ask this question a lot. Does that make sense? Usually to my family, because I appreciate clarity and assume others do as well. Much like ordering steak and naming children, language seems inherently and irrationally optimistic. We just assume other people understand what we are talking about. That we are, as the idiom goes, on the same wavelength. In my experience, we are not. "Total sense. I can see you being friends with Kit, actually. She's always been a nice kid. She used to come to all your birthday parties when you were little. Did you know that?" "No, though I'm not sure which birthday parties you attend when you're little is a fair reflection of your future character." My mother doesn't sigh. She's good at suppressing the impulse. But if Miney were here, that's exactly what she'd do. I've gotten better at hearing myself lately, I think. If she did sigh, I'd have deserved it. "I mean, you're right. She's nice." "And freakishly smart, like you," my mom says. Not sure the word freakish applies in any way to Kit. She's exceedingly normal. "And pretty," my mom says. Pretty doesn't fit Kit. It's too small a word, like her name. "Not pretty," I correct her. "Beautiful." Trey's on time, like usual, since he knows I don't like when people are late. He's wearing what he always wears, a conch shell on a leather string around his neck that he got in Bali, man. A ratty t-shirt with either a slogan, "Just do it," or a platitude, "YOLO," and flip-flops, even though it's winter. He's a student at Princeton, but he looks nothing like the guys on the cover of the university brochure he once brought over for me. He does not wear khakis or belts or a blazer, and he's not white. I once asked him what he was, and after he explained that was a rude question, he said, "A quarter Chinese, a quarter Indian, Southeast Asian, not Native American, and half African American." Kit's half Indian, but she looks nothing like Trey. which is just another example of why genetics is such a fascinating field.
How's things, buddy?
Trey asks after we run through a few finger-warming exercises. I realize this is what people call small talk. I also realize the world would be a better place without it. And why call me buddy? We are not friends. We are teacher and student. Fine, I say, and motion to the guitar to keep us on track. Maybe Trey has ADD. I should look up the diagnostic criteria in my DSM.
So hear me out, he says,
and I groan, because this is the thing about Trey, who, oddly enough, is the only person in my life who seems to have the exact right name. He's a kick-ass guitar teacher, but he doesn't stop at teaching me guitar, and I wish he'd learn to stick to his job. He likes to lecture about life and give me pointers for my notebook and challenge me to do things I'm not comfortable with. Like talk to someone new each week, which I did finally, but I might keep that to myself, because I don't want to give him the satisfaction. Or ask to borrow a pen from a classmate, which doesn't even make sense since we all use laptops. Or join the academic league, which seems to be a running theme in my life. So hear me out is code for I'm about to ask you to do something you don't want to do. I'm not usually good at understanding subtext, but Trey keeps things pretty simple.
There's this showcase I'm doing.
No, I say.
You don't even know what I'm going to say.
No, I say again. Let's work on Stairway.
I want you to perform.
No.
It's at a cafe, totally low-pressure situation, and a bunch of my other students will also be there.
Nope, not going to happen.
David, this will be good for you. And I think you'll like the others. They're all a lot like you.
Like me, how? I ask. Because even though I don't know what he means, I still don't like where this is going. He pauses, strokes his chin, which is hairless, a total Trey gesture, which I've imitated a few times in the mirror. It did not suit me.
They're all cool, and maybe a little shy. Not the type of people to feel comfortable doing a showcase.
Logic dictates that we shouldn't do one then, I say, and play a quick riff to let him know the conversation is over. Later, when I practice my daily Krav Maga, instead of using my go-to fantasy that I've been jumped in the street by a gang of thugs who mistake me for a rival gang member, admittedly an unrealistic story, since I do not live in a place known for its drug wars, I let myself picture someone stealing Kit's purse on Main Street. In my mind, I chase down the culprit and neutralize him with a swift groin kick and then an uppercut elbow. True, in Krav Maga, you are supposed to avoid confrontation and attack only in self-defense. But tonight, I allow myself this exception. As I sweat and kick and punch over and over again, I get to picture Kit's face, her cheeks pink, just like they were at lunch today. But instead of signaling embarrassment, this time, she's signaling pride.
Chapter 6. Kit. Violet and Annie are waiting for me outside the computer lab after school, and they have that look on their faces that I've come to think of as faux pity. Eyebrows scrunched up, concern dripping from their half-smiles, like they're about to stage an intervention, or like they are human emojis pre-manufactured to send a particular message. Or maybe it's real pity. I can't tell. Either way, I don't like the way it makes me feel. Reminders everywhere. Hey, I say. I keep it casual. Pretend I haven't broken many of the unspoken rules of our friendship, or that I don't know what's coming. I've ignored their calls and texts. I defected from our lunch table without explanation or reason. I never did give Violet my opinion on her high-waisted jeans. What's up? I think we should talk, Annie says. And though she's trying to be nice, I get the sense that underneath she's pissed off, but that she knows she's not allowed to be. My dad dying is the world's best and worst get-out-of-jail-free card. Violet puts an arm around my shoulder, and I try my best not to flinch. I don't want that kind of hug, a buck-up camper half-hug. But I play along. I blink back the first sting of tears. Violet's dressed in her usual uber-preppy uniform, a button-down shirt with a collar, her blonde hair kept off her face with a brain-squeezing headband, and twisted into a complicated braid that rests on one shoulder. She looks like a J. Crew model. She's basically the whitest person I've ever met. Annie's white, too. Mapleview is not a particularly diverse place. The default here is white. But she's less overtly white, if that makes sense. She's not at all preppy like Violet, and her parents don't golf at an exclusive country club, or try to casually mention something about India, or a random Indian person they know every time they talk to my mom. Annie's parents are liberal Jews who met while working for the Peace Corps in Kathmandu. They seem to understand that the world is a big, diverse place, and that different is not the same thing as scary. It's amazing to me how many people mistake the two. If I hadn't known Violet since we were in the fourth grade when her family first moved to Mapleview from Connecticut, I'd never have guessed that she and I would be best friends. The thing is, stiff collars and twee belts and subtly racist parents who have mastered the art of the microaggression notwithstanding, Violet's actually pretty gooey inside. She's the first to let me know if I have something caught in my teeth or stuck to my shoe. She writes long, inside joke-filled messages in my yearbook in pink and purple ink. When Violet first heard about the accident, she drove straight over to my house and waited on my front stoop until my mom and I got home. And then she hugged me before I even had a chance to get out of the car. She's been doing everything right, been following the best friend handbook to the letter. It's not her fault that I suddenly don't know how to talk to my friends. That I'd almost prefer it if they got pissed at me instead. My friendship with Annie and Violet has always worked because we balance each other out. Annie's clashing prints and crazy jumpsuits clothes perfectly aligned with her personality. Without her, I'm pretty sure we would spend every Saturday night in Violet's basement eating Oreos and vicariously party-going via Instagram. Annie makes us live bigger lives, which of course are still of Mapleview dimensions. Which is to say, very, very small, but you know, still bigger than they would be otherwise. You guys, this whole lunch thing doesn't rise to the level of needing a talk. I've just been a little MIA, I say, and use this opportunity to shift my backpack to the other shoulder, a way to dislodge Violet's arm without being rude. I've just been busy. Annie's been the source of my entire social life since elementary school. She's the reason we spend most afternoons at the Pizza Palace, as satellites to planets Justin and Gabriel. She's the reason we have front of the caf seating. She's the reason we get invited to actual parties. In my world, there's no such thing as busy without her. WTF? Annie asks. She sometimes speaks in text, a habit I just can't get behind. In my head, I respond in kind. OMG, FML, TTYL. Annie, chill, Violet says. Sorry, I don't mean it that way, Annie says, giving me another one of those winces, as if she's doing something painful, like getting her eyebrows waxed. I'm worried about you, Kit. You should talk to us. We're your best friends. I just need a little space, I say. It's obviously not you guys, it's me. Why are you talking like you're breaking up with us? It's not you, it's me. I need space. Annie laughs, trying to lighten the mood, as if she can turn my words into a joke and we can giggle our way out of this one. I almost say, OTT. I almost say, laughs need to be earned now. I almost say, please just stop. I almost say, I'm sorry. It's so not a big deal. It's lunch, I say. Kit means she's having a tough time because of everything, Violet says. I shake off my irrational annoyance at her euphemism. Everything is obviously my dad being dead. Why can't she just say that instead? Even when the doctor came out of the emergency room to break the news to my mom and me, he used what my English teacher likes to call purple prose. We've lost him, he said. He's gone. Like my dad was a credit card left behind at the supermarket, or a puppy that slipped out the front door. Yesterday, David just said the words right out loud, the unvarnished, ugly truth. Duh, that's why you have friends in the first place, so we can help you, Annie says. I look at her, wonder how she defines helping. Probably by trying to revive the old Kit. The pre-everything Kit. But that's impossible. The old Kit is as dead as my father. We lost her, I think. She's gone. This isn't healthy, the way you're shutting us out, Annie says. Healthy, I repeat back in a flat tone, because suddenly I don't know what that word means. What does healthy have to do with how I'm feeling? The sort of unimaginable pain that makes it hard for me to get from one moment to the next. I know we've only been standing here for minutes, but it feels like hours or days. Time has turned interminable and impenetrable, something to be endured and passed through however possible. Health isn't a factor. This can't be fixed with talking or green juice. Everything will not be fixed by a 48-hour cleanse. I wish I could say all this out loud, but I can't. I don't know how. Girls! Mr. Galto, the newspaper advisor, calls to us from inside the classroom, sighing the sigh of teachers immemorial, as if we are difficult inmates instead of AP honors students. If you want a chance at editor-in-chief, you better get yourselves in here. Since I'm not gifted athletically or musically or anything ickly, I've been gunning for the EIC position forever. Violet and Annie both want it too. It's how girls like us pad our college applications without having to sweat or join marching band. Today is the day we officially put ourselves up for nomination. I've missed a few deadlines lately, but I'm hoping my get-out-of-jail-free card extends to extracurriculars. Please, I say to Annie and Violet, which is the worst word I could have used because that look is back. Real pity this time. I can see it through my grief haze. Please, what? Annie asks, her voice so gentle that it almost breaks me. Annie is not supposed to be gentle. Annie is supposed to be aggressive, and sometimes a little mean because she's the only one of us who takes risks and gets shit done. Annie is supposed to tell me to get over it and stop wallowing, and maybe we could have a fight about that, about how little she understands what's going on with me right now, since anything would be better than this. My lower lip starts to quiver, and I realize that if I stand here for one more second, I will burst into tears, right in the hallway, just after the last bell, when there's maximum foot traffic. Nope. Not going to cry here. Not going to happen. Last chance, Mr. Galto calls from inside the room. I do the only thing I can. I split. I throw away almost 3 whole years of work on the newspaper and my one shot at editor-in-chief. I sprint down the hall. When I finally get to my car, which I realize as soon as I get in is the last place in the world I want to be, I crank the windows wide open and blast the air conditioner. I turn up the radio. The tears don't come. I'm too shaken to put the car into drive. Instead, I sit and stare at the clock on the dashboard, marvel at how the numbers stay still. Please, please, please. I whisper again and again and again an empty chant, because I still don't know what I'm begging for. The landline, which has an actual spiral cord and is attached to the wall like this is the 18th century or something, rings. Our just-in-case-of-an-emergency phone that my dad insisted we install even though we each have our own cell. That's how he was. Every year in celebration of his birthday, he'd change the batteries in our fire alarm and carbon monoxide detector. In the event of a Category 6 hurricane or a zombie apocalypse, we have a kit in our basement full of dried meats and canned foods and gallons of water. And on the fridge, there's a laminated card with the number for poison control, even though I'm 16 and unlikely to accidentally swallow a dishwashing gel pack. "You never know," he used to say. "You just never know. Unimaginably bad stuff happens." My dad was orphaned in his early 20s. Both of my paternal grandparents died of cancer within a year of each other. Bone for my grandfather, breast for my grandmother Catherine, my namesake. "Alliterative cancers," my dad would joke. "A freak thing." It never occurred to me to think about what losing both of his parents must have been like. What it cost him to be forced to speak so casually about it to me, who was so stupid, who had never before weighed the magnitude of forever, who laughed at the juxtaposition of the words alliterative and cancer, like that was such a clever thing for him to say. My mom told me that my father totally changed after his parents died. He stopped drinking beer with his buddies, put away his electric guitar, and cut his 90s grunge hair. He started taking their relationship, which they'd both assumed was just a college fling, more seriously. He applied to dental school despite having no particular passion for teeth or gums or the diagnosis of gingivitis. Practically overnight, he graduated to adulthood. He picked stability and practicality over passion. Now I think about the box that my dad so carefully created for me. Not just the one in the basement, but this safe town. This house with an alarm system. This family of three. And how it did nothing to protect us after all. Those were just things my dad did to make himself feel better. I realize we all walk around pretending we have some control over our fate. Because to recognize the truth, that no matter what we do, the bottom will fall out when we least expect it, is just too unbearable to live with. The phone rings again, and I jump, like I'm in a horror movie. I'm equally scared to answer and not answer.
"Kitty?"
It's Uncle Jack, my dad's best friend and my godfather. He was my dad's freshman year college roommate, the best man at my parents' wedding, and a frequent house guest over the past year since his wife left him. Last month, he added the job of executor of my father's estate. "What's wrong?" I ask, because this is the in-case-of-emergency phone. It is used to report emergencies. "Nothing. Everything's fine. Well, not fine, but you know."
"Is your mom around by any chance? I called her office and they said she wasn't in."
"My mom left for work as usual this morning, looking even better than yesterday."
"Sorry, not home."
I've known Uncle Jack my entire life. The uncle being an Indian honorific we use out of respect, even though he's not technically family. Or Indian, for that matter. He used to pull pennies out from behind my ear, bend his thumb so it looked like it split in two. He came to my eighth grade graduation ceremony just because he wanted to see me cross the stage. He has been saying the same thing in different ways for the past month, and I don't want to hear it again.
"It was just a freak thing."
I think about how the police told us about the malfunctioning traffic light. There was a work order to fix it later in the week. That when they administered a breathalyzer about 2 hours after the accident, the other driver was under the legal limit, that there was no crime here, nothing to prosecute. I think of the way the other car plowed through the intersection into my dad. Literally, into my dad. That's what killed him. The impact. My mom doesn't know that the day after he died, when she was taking a Xanax nap, I took a cab to the junkyard to see for myself what was left of the car. I needed to make it feel real, to have evidence that my father was in fact dead, Not lost, like the doctor said, not just waiting somewhere else for us to find him. There was nothing to see but Volvo Origami. I took a picture, but it felt no more real than before. The accident was a blank. A story that was told to us about characters we did not know, lives we did not care about. But there was the car, and my father was dead, and I was not. I was not. I never got to meet my father's parents, my other grandparents, and if I ever have kids, they will not get to know my dad. If I one day walk down an aisle, my dad will not be standing next to me. At graduation, it will be just my mom in the audience watching. Every happy moment from now on will have the lingering, bitter, heartbreaking aftertaste of loss.
It was just a freak thing, Jack says, right on cue.
It's wrong that his words so precisely echo my father's. He uses the same empty refrain. For the first time, I hear the lie implicit in them, realize how the freakishness does nothing to lessen the reality. It's a misdirection. It's a verbal sleight of hand. Not the truth. Not truth at all. That night, my mom comes into my room to tuck me in, something she hasn't done in a long time, maybe years. These days, we've been falling asleep mid-activity, stuffed with too much takeout. We just keep going until our bodies shut off.
Sweetie?
My mom sits next to me on my bed, which makes the covers too tight across my neck. I don't ask her to shift over. I've taken 4 Advil to get rid of this unidentifiable feeling, a shaky emptiness, but Advil doesn't treat whatever this is.
I ran into Violet's mom today on the train.
Yeah? She mentioned curry. I ask, as if I have no idea what's coming next. Of course, it was only a matter of time before one of my friends said something to their mom, and their mom said something to my mom, like how we used to play the game telephone as kids and whisper secrets from ear to ear. My mom laughs at my non-joke.
Not this time. But she said that Violet told her you haven't been sitting with the girls at lunch.
My mom smooths down my hair, which is 2 shades lighter than hers. I've always wanted to color mine dark brown so we could match. When I was little, I was convinced that my mom was actually a superhero, that Mandeep Lowell was just a secret identity, that every night after I went to sleep, she'd spend her evenings fighting crime, kicking bad guys with a loud hi-ya. Now I think she could totally play one of those two pretty cops on a network television drama, the kind that sprint down dead-end alleys on a studio set, prop gun raised and pointed, "Stop, or I'll shoot!" She's tough, my mother, and she can run in heels. Though, let's be honest, she's much more likely to be cast as a terrorist, or a head-wagging taxi driver, or a convenience store clerk. We don't often get to see people who look and sound like her on television. It's no big deal, Mom. I just needed a little space. She nods like she gets it. And maybe she does.
I can't stand the thought of you sitting alone.
I've been sitting with this guy, David Drucker. He's okay.
David Drucker, Amy's son? He used to be an odd duck.
She tugs at my hair with her finger, and it springs right back into a wave. No doubt my mother is disappointed when she looks at me, her only child. Beautiful women are supposed to have beautiful daughters. At the very least, I bet she thought I'd turn out exotic, an obnoxious word that every biracial person has heard like a million times. Though in my case, it's never really applied. My parents' features have come together to form someone easily forgettable. My skin is just brown enough that in this super white suburb, people sometimes are rude enough to ask me, "What are you?" They seem disappointed when I don't say Latina, which is everyone's first guess. Like figuring out my ethnicity is some sort of fun game.
You used to go to David's birthday parties when you were little,
my mom says. He's still totally weird, but it turns out he might be good weird, you know? I look at my mom and think about how there are no brown superheroes, and about the fact that I'm probably too chubby to be on television. Maybe I should straighten my hair, darken it too, spend a little bit more time in the sun. That way my mom and I could look more alike. Without my father standing next to us, we don't make that much sense together. I want to tell her David was Dad's patient, but I can't say that word out loud. Dad. Really? So you want to start playing with David again? My mom raises her eyebrows. It's not like that. Is he still cute? I find myself smiling up at the ceiling in the dark, and I almost laugh out loud. Because of all the guys in my school, of all the guys in the whole wide world, I'm thinking about David Drucker, the oddest of ducks. He is cute, sort of, but he's still David Drucker. Any port in a storm, my love, any port in a storm, my mom says and laughs.
Chapter 7. David. I cross my fingers. Childish, yes, and of course irrational. I am not superstitious. I don't believe in made-up things like fate. I believe in science, in what we can see and feel and calculate with well-calibrated instruments. Still, 3 days in a row of Kit sitting at my table seems like the probability equivalent of flipping a coin 100 times and consistently getting heads. That sort of thing just doesn't happen. No doubt I said something accidentally offensive yesterday, as I'm prone to do, and we will no longer be friends if you can classify sitting together twice and talking in the bleachers as friendship. I do, of course, but I'm sure Kit has a higher tipping point. I recounted our conversation verbatim to Miney, and she said that under no circumstances should I ever talk about a girl's weight again, even if they bring it up first. She was so adamant about this that she made me put it in the rules section of my notebook. As a corollary, there is also only one correct answer when a girl poses the question, "Do I look fat?" That answer is no. Which is why I cross my fingers, hoping against hope that I haven't ruined things already, and that, despite all evidence to the contrary, wanting something can actually will it to happen. 5 minutes into our lunch period, just as my optimism dissipates, there she is, Kit Lowell, walking directly toward my table. Maybe soon our table, though I don't know how many times we'll have to sit together for the plural possessive to be appropriate. I took notes for you in physics yesterday, I say as she takes out today's lunch, which is leftover Indian takeout. Hopefully from Star of Punjab, which is the second highest rated Indian place on Yelp in Mapleview. My dad and I both refuse to patronize the number one ranked Curryland, despite the statistical significance of the additional 7 5-star reviews in their favor, because as a rule, we avoid restaurants that rely on a theme, especially one as nonsensical as pretending that each customer is a tourist in a mythical place called Curryland. "Thanks," she says, scooping both rice and a piece of naan onto her plate. A double serving of carbohydrates, which is a bad idea if she is, as she suggested yesterday, worried about gaining weight. I keep this observation to myself. Thank you, Miney. I don't usually take notes, and I bet your friends did it for you too, but I figured mine would be better, I say. She frowns at me, a common expression of displeasure, and I wonder where I've gone wrong. I've also made an outline for her for AP English Lit and AP World History, but Miney said not to offer these up unless she asks for them. I don't want to be over the top, whatever that means. Holy crap, you don't kid around, Kit says as she looks at my notes, which include elaborate three-dimensional drawings for each step of our lab experiment with potassium permanganate, and just like that, her face transforms. A smile. Which means I've made her happy. These must have taken you forever. They're beautiful, for reals. Not forever, approximately 76 minutes. These aren't physics notes, this is art. Seriously, you didn't have to do this. Seriously, I wanted to, I say. Well, thank you. Seriously, she says. More banter, which may be my new favorite word. Star of Punjab? I ask. Yep, I don't like Curryland. It's like Indian food for idiots, Kit says. I am grinning, but I can't help it. Want some? I nod, even though I don't like to share food. Kit looks perfectly healthy, robust even, and anyhow, she'd be worth getting sick for, presuming I don't catch something that lingers like mononucleosis. At my house, my dad is the one who does most of the cooking, with the exception of Tuesday's pasta night, since my mother is Italian. I wonder if dentist was interested in the culinary arts, which would explain Kit's family's recently acquired affinity for takeout. She used to eat only sandwiches, though I sat too far away from her old table to decipher what kind. You'd probably be surprised to learn that I'm a very good chef. I can make this, I say, pointing to the chicken tikka. Really? My mom keeps promising she'll teach me how to cook one day, but she never has the time. How'd you learn? She leans forward, resting her chin on her hand. Her elbows are 20 centimeters from mine. Our knees are even closer. Better measured in millimeters. I wish I could take out my tape measure, because it would feel good to fix an exact number to the distance, a measurement that I could then write on a piece of paper and put in my pocket and take out on days when I needed the reassurance of a number. I like science. Gastronomy seemed a natural extension. I don't mention that I also cook to help out at home sometimes, especially with Miney away, because teen movies have made clear that it's not cool to help out your parents, which makes little sense to me, as does everything else about the word cool. Please don't take this the wrong way, but you're so weird, she says. I look at her, or at least her chin, and discover that an offhand comment by Kit can disrupt my respiration. But good weird, you know? Good weird. Good weird is what I've been telling myself I am for years, when being just plain weird was too much of a burden to carry. Good weird is the only solution to the problem, when normal isn't a viable option. Good weird may very well be the opposite of cool, but I've never aspired to cool. At least not the version of it I'm familiar with. Thank you. Speaking of weird, I have a random question for you. What can you tell me about quantum mechanics? Kit asks, and a shiver makes its way from the bottom of my spine all the way to the top. Miney suggested that I think up some small talk ideas in case Kit came back to my table today. Top of my list? Quantum mechanics. It's almost enough to make me reconsider the entire concept of fate. Maybe it's because my brain is so saturated with Kit that I forget to keep my head down and my eyes trained on the floor. I have my headphones on, of course, but my volume is turned lower than usual because, unlike usual, I don't want to drown out my thoughts with sound. I want to dwell on lunch today, to replay Kit's, well, thank you, seriously, over and over again. Her smile, too. How our conversation went back and forth, specific and precise, leaving little room for misunderstanding. David! David! Jose says, and waves his hands in my face so I have no choice but to stop and pause the music on my phone. This encounter will throw me off schedule, which means that there is little chance of Symphony No. 36 in C ending just as I slip into my seat in physics. Damn it.